Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Appropriately, on this day, we go straight to a relative of one of the 48 people who died in the Stardust disaster nearly 15,750 days ago, and are waiting on the verdict of an inquest. Lisa Lawler. Lisa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You were orphaned. Your parents died in the fire. You were an only child at the time. What are you hoping for today about the death of your parents, Francis and Maureen?
Francis and Maureen, I'm hoping for justice today. I'm hoping that we can do this today.
And I'm very hopeful. Okay, and the verdict the your legal team were looking for is unlawful killing.
Indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Just describe what it's like down there now, Lisa, for you.
For me, I'm extremely nervous. I'm very anxious. I'm also very emotional today, Joe.
Yeah.
This is a big day. This is a big day today. I'm very thankful for everyone that's around me and everyone that's supporting us. And I'm very thankful for that. Very emotional today.
I can understand that. And you're only 17 months, but I'm thinking your parents would be, if the two of them had survived, they'd be younger than I am, Lisa.
Yeah,
they'd be in
they're twice my age now.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I look at it like that, it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I knew about Stardust before I was out in Eppies, before I could walk.
You were 17 months at the time.
Your mum
and dad were in their early 20s. They went around to the Stardust. It was February 13th going into Valentine's Day. What were you told? Obviously, you didn't know what was happening, Lisa, but what were you told?
No, well, obviously, I didn't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm going on secondhand information all kind of my life. I never heard them walking, never saw them talking. I didn't know any different, you know. But the loss is so great inside my soul. I know they're around me today, Joe.
Most definitely.
I can feel the presence of them around me today.
Yeah,
it's a huge day.
Yeah. And the families have been absolutely incredible. I don't know how, given the grief that you're all going through, continue to go through, where you all found the strength to continue fighting against decisions. First of all, the decision of you wouldn't remember it, but I would, because I was there in 1981. When the Justice Ronan Keane Tribunal, that happened up in a place called the Incorporated Law Society there up near Smithfield. And I sat through it every day. And we were all surprised at the end when the verdict came through that Justice Keane believed that the fire had been started deliberately. Now, that was subsequently, thanks to the work of the families, that was subsequently overturned. But as I say, a lot of the evidence at the time, and a lot of the Gardaí said there was absolutely no evidence that the fire was started deliberately.
Yeah.
How did you find the inquest in the rotunda?
I found it very stressful, but also I knew that we would come to the end of it.
Yeah.
And today I'm very, very hopeful, Joe, and I'm very, very emotional, and I'm very feeling very strong today.
Yeah,
I don't know how, but I am.
And Lisa, I was struck in the few times I was down there. One, I was struck by how caring the staff were of all the relatives. They were very...
They've been amazing.
Yeah, they've been amazing.
Amazing legal team, amazing people around us. That's what we need.
And
we need that.
And a very calm, and this is at the great work of the coroner, Myra Cullinan, the tranquility of the room, the fact that everyone could see everything, could hear everything. And people were looked after. As I say, there was a cup of tea for the families if they wanted it.
Yeah.
And there was a biscuit as well if they needed a little break, because it is very, 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 very harrowing. So, Lisa...
even more ironic that I was born 20 steps away from here. So
in the rotunda.
Today is a monumentous day. Yeah.
And it's happening in a very historic building, but its history pales into insignificance. to the fact that we're talking about the lives of 48 very, very young people. The majority of them, a lot of them age 16 and 17. Lisa, I let you go in and I'll let
Thank you very much, Joe.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a great day. Yeah. Thanks very much, Joe.
Lisa's carrying the photographs of Frances and Maureen. We're also joined by John O'Dowd from the UCD Sutherland School of Law. Why did it end up in the coroner's court, John?
Well, there was an original inquest, but that very much confined itself to the mechanics of death. It was didn't explore the circumstances because the Keane Tribunal was looking at that at the time. And I think when the Attorney General, Seamus Wolfe, at the time in 2019, looked back at the case and the fact that, you know, a central finding of the Keane inquiry had been subsequently set aside, as you mentioned earlier, he decided you had to bring all these things back together again and have a proper inquest on this occasion.
And then what is the level of proof needed at an inquest compared to a court of law?
Well, there are five possible verdicts. Yeah. And there's only one of them, unlawful killing, that requires proof beyond reasonable doubt. And the other four is just proof on the balance of probabilities. Is it more likely than not that the death occurred in this particular manner?
And then if it is, the families, you know, are hoping, and the legal teams argued extraordinarily strongly in their closing submissions that it should be unlawful killing. What would that mean?
Well, it would indicate that somebody had displayed a very high degree of disregard of an obvious danger that could have been avoided following the standards that were applicable at the time. But it's important to understand that that can't involve the jury attributing blame, culpability to any particular individual or organisation or company. They can just declare in the abstract that the deaths were the result of unlawful killing. They can't censure anybody. They can't exonerate anybody either. There must be no identified individual or identifiable individual.
And can the Gardaí?
They can certainly review the evidence that's been given at the inquest and see if that evidence is still available and admissible in a criminal.
And is there a statute of limitation to this day?
Not in a criminal matter.
Okay,
no.
Okay. Say what as John would be saying. Una Kelly from our newsroom is down. I think you're outside the pillar room at this stage, Una. What's happening?
I'm just standing outside the pillar room in the grounds of the Rotunda Hospital here. Now, we're expecting the formalities to get underway at about 2 o'clock. Now, the room is absolutely packed. So many family members have shown up today, and we were just told as well that all of the legal representatives have given up their seats in the room so that the families can fit in there. And media representatives have been told just one person from each organisation inside, as there are so many people here in attendance today. I've been here outside the gate since around 11 o'clock this morning, and things were fairly quiet. We could see some of the family members coming in quietly. For example, Mrs. McDermott, who's in her 80s, she lost three children that night. She came in here quietly about half an hour or so ago. But, you know, the sense of anticipation, I think, now has really reached its peak when you think that we're in the final few minutes now of a 43-year wait to find out exactly what happened. And when it kicks off at 2, what we understand is going to happen is that the jury foreperson will read out the 48 individual verdicts one by one. So it will cover, we understand, things like where that person was last seen, the cause of their death, etc. And then there will also be some information read out about the determination of the cause of the fire, how and why that started.
Mm-hmm. As you say, the room is absolutely jam-packed. And when was it announced that the media will be limited to one representative per organisation?
This was around 10 or 15 minutes ago. They were apologetic. I think they just hadn't anticipated the crowds that would be here. So they're trying to organise things as best as they can. But I think at the moment we're just waiting for things to kick off. Where I'm standing, they have the doors open and you can see in the windows. So there's plenty of people milling around, and we're just expecting that to get underway shortly.
Okay, and I see earlier on I saw the photograph of Bridget McDermott arriving. Bridget is the mother of three children, Georgie McDermott, as he was known, Marcella McDermott and Willie McDermott. And Willie McDermott actually escaped from the Stardust, but when he realised that his brother and sister were still missing, he went in. He went back into the Stardust and he perished in there as well. So there's three children Bairn, Bridget's three children, three of her, she thinks with eight children, that's named George, Marcella and William. And are there many people gathered outside, and do we know, is there an arrangement for after the verdicts, after the coroner's court is finished this afternoon, Una?
So what we understand, Joe, at the moment is that when the hearing concludes, once they've gone through all the 48 individual verdicts and then the general one as well about the cause of the fire, that the families say that they will walk out together holding a banner with the photos of the 48 victims with the phrase "they never came home," and they'll also be carrying photographs of their loved ones. They'll then walk up to the Garden of Remembrance, to the steps there with the song "You'll Never Walk Alone." We think they'll then gather on the steps and hold a press conference with their solicitor, Dara Mackin. And then the families are expected that they'll be available to speak to the media after that.
Okay, and it's worth people, I hope people know that horrific reminder, that image of the 48, four rows of photographs, 12 photographs in each row across. The photograph, when you go into the pillar room for the inquest, on a very large board at the where the families were sitting, where those... that images of the 48, most of them, because that was the times we were living in, most of them were in black and white, and some of them are quite grainy because it wasn't the world of iPhones, and it wasn't the world of every household, especially in working class areas of Artane, Kilmore and Coolock, having cameras. But Una, I know you will keep us up to date. We're going to take a quick break. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Today, remember the names Michael Barrett, Richard Bennett, Carol Bissett, James Buckley, Paula Bourne, Caroline Carey, John Colgan, Jacqueline Croker, Liam Dunn, Michael Farrell, David Flood, Thelma Fraser, Michael French, Josephine Glenn, Michael Griffiths, Robert Hillock, Brian Hobbs, Eugene Hogan, Morta Kavanagh, Martina Keegan, Mary Keegan, her sister, Robert Kelly, Mary Kennedy, Mary Kenny, Margaret Kiernan, Sandra Lawless, Francis Lawler and his wife Maureen Lawler, Paula Lewis, Eamon Lockman, George McDermott, Marcella McDermott, William McDermott, siblings, Julia MacDonald, Teresa MacDonald, Gerard McGrath, Caroline McHugh, Donna Mahan, Helena Mangan, James Miller, Susan Morgan, David Morton, Kathleen Muldoon, George O'Connor, Brendan O'Mara, John Stout, Margaret Thornton and Paul Wade. It takes just over a minute to read out the names. It has taken over 40 years for the families to feel they are on the cusp of a milestone moment for them in finding out what happened. Their parents, their brothers, their sisters, their aunties, their uncles and their nieces, their nephews. John O'Dowd, have we any idea how long this could go on for a number of hours, obviously?
It could, because each individual verdict has to be gone through, yes, in relation to each of the 48.
And then at the start, one of the, I think, very moving things that the coroner instructed was that every one of the 48 victims not only should be named and their ages, and they were all, the majority of them were all age under 20, remember, even though the age limit for getting into the club was over 20. Mm-hmm. But the majority of them were under 20, and the coroner insisted that each one would have their own time in the coroner's court, that a member of the family or a relative or indeed a friend where it was asked to read out details about every individual. Mm. And for example, when the it was done alphabetically, obviously in the first detail read by Gertrude Barrett, the mother of Michael Barrett, who's 17, from Raheny, and one of the lines, she said he was a very ambitious and he'd very clear plans and dreams. He was a son, she said, a brother, a grandson, a nephew, a cousin, a friend and a neighbour. He's the eldest of our four children. He had one sister and two brothers. For such a short life, Michael left an impression on everyone, on the people he met, be it for a minute, a day or a week. Michael was always smiling and had an infectious laugh. Michael had a wicked sense of humour and he loved cracking jokes and playing pranks. He was optimistic, positive about his life going forward. Remember, he was only 17. He was ambitious and very clear plans, dreams, hopes and wishes for the future. He was going to make it. Like, all 17-year-olds. Get rich too, he said. And what 17-year-old, his mother said, isn't going to say that. He worked hard, he saved hard, and he had several hobbies and interests, including football and DJing. And up until that awful night, February 13th into February the 14th, the Friday into Saturday night, Gertrude said, we were a happy family unit, four children, doing regular things, living a life. On February the 14th, 1981, we were catapulted into unimaginable grief and sorrow. I went to Coolock Garda Station. There we were told to go down to the Malahide Road and get the bus into Store Street and the City Morgue. I spent 4 days in total in the City Morgue and Store Street, waiting, waiting and waiting. Michael will be the last identified victim of the Stardust. I was told by the Garda that his body will be released to the undertakers on Thursday. He was buried on February the 20th, Friday, 1981. His funeral was impersonal and rushed. We were told what was happening, told the body would be released to Jennings undertakers, told the funeral time and date, just like I was told to get the bus into Store Street, told everything and asked nothing. My children not only watched my struggle, but also had to live with a mother's grief. As a family, we will never recover from the trauma of the Stardust fire and its effects. It has been absolutely crippling at times. Rest in peace, Michael, Gertrude said. We miss you and everything about you every single day. And that's just one testimony from one of the families of the victims, the 48 victims of the Stardust fire. The coroner's court, as you know, has been online, which is in itself another testament to the accessibility of this coroner, Maura Cullinan, and they hope to go online again. I presume there's countless thousands trying to access the online feed at this stage to see. But as I say, the courtroom is absolutely packed. Hundreds of family members, standing room only. It's the famous pillar room, as I say. I think the remains of Countess Markovic were laid out there many, many years ago. And it looks like, you'll see photographs of the room hereafter, it looks like a very historic room. A handful of survivors, the parents are here, obviously, as I said, Lisa and Lisa's parents, Francis and Maureen, they would have only been in their 60s if they had survived. But remember, the most of those who died were under 20, and their parents would be moving on in age now, 43 years later. They'd be well into their 60s, 70s and indeed 80s. So, and the number of parents, as you know, and Antoinette Keegan is a sister and her mother, a great campaigner, died in the last 2 years. So the parents, unfortunately, age was catching up with them, and stress and grief and hurt and pain and the burden. The legal teams in the pillar room at the inquest, and the legal teams, by the way, took up the biggest element of the biggest section of the room when I was there, because there are a number of different legal teams representing Dublin Corporation, the Gardaí, and indeed a number of different legal teams representing different groups of the family. And then there was a small area reserved for the media. But the legal teams have all given up their a significant portion of the room, in fairness to them, and I presume they're now standing at the back and they're allowing survivors. And the coroner is now entering the pillar room, and she has taken her seat, as has been wanted. It is a very formal setting, but it has the addition of the fact that it's very well accessed technically and otherwise, in that the everyone can hear and see indeed what's going on. I don't know. Tara Lockwood Grant has hit me. I don't know whether is with me. Has the coroner started talking yet? No,
she's just starting, Joe.
And what's she saying? Just a general introduction?
She said she's going to address the jury and the foreman of the jury who's going to deliver the findings.
Okay.
Just about to start, and the family are sitting, as Una said, with pictures in hand, listening.
Okay, okay. And John, the jury, there is always a jury in an inquest. Is it the same as the jury we're used to?
Well, in this case, there were some alternate jurors because it was anticipated the inquest might go on so long. But it is broadly the same, apart, of course, from the fact that the majority required to reach a verdict is only 7 out of the 12.
Okay. Yeah. And the four-person of the jury is now speaking. Is that right, Tara?
Listening to her now, and she just asked the foreman to confirm that they reached a unanimous
decision. Majority verdict, yeah.
Majority verdict, not unanimous.
Okay, that's still going on. But the difference is the same as in a court of law, John. Mm. You're asked for a unanimous, and if that doesn't happen,
exactly,
which obviously didn't.
But they've just made the point that it's the same verdict in relation to all the 48.
Oh, have they? Mm. Okay, so it is the same verdict for the 48. Okay, so there'll be no... In other words, the first verdict, when we get it, will be the verdict for everybody. We will know then. Okay, okay. And as I see, the coroner is still addressing the foreperson of the jury, who is a man. And the jury, when I was there, they were all, it seemed every single one of them were taking notes. And remember, they sat through 100 days in the centre of Dublin. Even the logistics, I was thinking, on the few days for the jury to get in there every single day. I hope there was arrangements for them, but the logistics for them to get in every single day in itself would have been difficult. What's the coroner saying now, Tara?
The foreman is now passing the individual questionnaires in relation to the findings. So the judge is just very clearly, step by step, going through what's about to happen so that it's, I suppose, very clear for the families.
Yeah.
There were murmurs and gasps there when the foreman confirmed that it will be as John
okay,
said.
It looks like the coroner has been handed 48 files, basically.
Yes.
And she, I presume, will go through each one of them one by one to give the verdict, and I presume, like in everything that's been happening up to now, will be done alphabetically. So the coroner, very conscious of, we can only see the coroner obviously, but she's obviously addressing the families sitting in front of her, and she is acknowledging their presence almost in everything she says. What is the coroner saying now, Tara?
This is exactly as you said, Dr. Myra Cullinan, very, very methodically explaining every single step and going through the questions as were put to the jury and the foreman. And now they're starting with Michael Barrett, who you described there as his mother had, Gertrude, had written about.
Okay, so she's now they're now dealing with the case of Michael Barrett, as I read out the details.
Yes.
17 years of age, from Raheny. His mother, as I read out just now, gave out the description, and of each of the 48 victims were humanised in this court deliberately, I think, by the coroner, when she insisted that every one of the 48 be acknowledged in terms of pen pictures of their hobbies, their lives, their ambitions. What's happening now, Tara?
She is asking the foreman to discuss the place of death of Michael Barrett, and it was describing it as inhalation of fire fumes at the Stardust Club on the night of Valentine's night.
Mm-hmm. John?
And then the verdict will follow later, which is the same for all of them. So they're going through the details of each.
Oh, so she won't give a verdict on Michael Barrett?
No, the jury gives the verdict, but yes. They're going through the answers to the questionnaires in relation to each individual, when they were identified, what was the mechanism of death, what was the place and time and date of death. And then once they've gone through all the questionnaires, the verdict, which covers all of them, will follow.
Okay, so we might not know a verdict until a number of hours hence.
Until they've gone through all the questionnaires. Although they're going through them fairly quickly. Yeah.
Okay.
So the type of questions that she's asking is date of identification and the medical cause of the person's death, the date of the death, and the location. So exactly as John said, they're going through each of the 48 victims, and then we will get the verdict at the end.
Okay. So as I say, the jury foreman has said that the jury has reached the same verdict in each of the 48 cases.
Yes.
We'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And the coroner is moving through each of the victims. She began, as I said, it's being done alphabetically with Michael Barrett. Then Richard Bennett, 17, from Coolock. As his family said, he was a father figure to his younger brother and sister. And the tribute to Richard Bennett was read into the coroner's court by Christine Muir, who was asked to do so on behalf of his mother, Helen. Then Carol Bissett is being referred to. She was 18, from Ringsend. And as her mother, Betty, said at the beginning of this inquest, "I will never stop wondering, where would she be in her life today?" Can you imagine? She'd be in her late 50s, read by her mother, Betty, and a poem read by her sister, Liz. Then the coroner referred to Jimmy Buckley, again, only 23 years of age, from Donnycarney, 5 minutes from the Stardust. His brother, Errol Buckley, said about him at the beginning of the inquest, "My father figure, brother, my hero." Then Paula Bourne from Coolock, 19 again. And as her sister Marie said, which was a lovely way to put it, she was the peacemaker in our house. Paula's position in our family was right in the middle. She was the youngest of her older sister and three brothers, and the eldest of her three younger brothers. A typical family at the time. She was always the peacemaker in our house. Going to bed on an argument was not in Paula Bourne's nature. Then the coroner referred to Caroline Carey, 17 years of age, from Kilmore West. And her sister Maria said, "Our beautiful, bubbly, witty Caroline is gone. Our beautiful, bubbly, witty Caroline is gone." Only 17 years of age. And remember, she would still, if she was still alive, she would still be in only in her 50s. John Colgan has been referred to, 21, from Swords. His sister Susan Behan said he was full of life, always upbeat. Who is the coroner talking about now, Tara?
Jacqueline Croker.
Yeah. 18 She's years just, of age, from yes. Kilmore West. She loved Dolly Parton, Johnny Logan, John Lennon and Diana Ross. And that tells you a little bit about the times that were in the 1980s in Ireland. A depressing time in many ways. Lots of unemployment. Charles Haughey was a Taoiseach at the time. The Stardust on the north side of Dublin, the biggest venue in the area. It's opposite for today's travellers and people who go through Artane. It's opposite the Artane shopping centre. There's a Lidl there around it now. There was a Van Gogh art exhibition in the warehouse beside it. But in the main part of that complex there was the Stardust. And it was a factory, believe it or not, a factory that was converted into a nightclub. And indeed, Eamon Butterley said in the inquest, he was asked, is there anything he would do all over again? And he said, "Well, I wouldn't change a factory into a nightclub." I presume the coroner now, Tara, is talking about Liam Dunn, 18. And by the way, lots of cause of death is a rapid incapacitation. This is for different, just for Jacqueline Croker. Death by inhalation of fire fumes. Liam Dunn from Coolock, "Our family had so much hope he would pull through," said his sister, Siobhan Kearney. And Liam Dunn, again, you can nearly guess the ages yourself as I go along, 18 years of age. What's happening now, John?
She's now talking about Michael French.
Okay, well, then I refer to, in fairness, Thelma Fraser, who she just spoken about, 20, from Ringsend. "A smile so broad and a laugh filled with spring." And that tribute was composed and read by her siblings, Barbara Morris and Eric Fraser. Thelma Fraser, 20, from Ringsend. Michael Farrell, who was Thelma Fraser's boyfriend. He was also killed in the Stardust. He was 26 years of age. He loved Payday, his niece said on behalf of Michael's sister. He loved Payday. He made sure her mom always got her wages. And that was the way in those days, I can tell you. Your mother got the opened the wage packet. You never, little brown wage packet. We all got, and you'd peel back the envelope and it'd be well gummed and well glued. And if you peeled it back once, it was open. So you couldn't open it before you got home to your mother. And Michael Farrell, as his sibling said, he loved Payday. He made sure our mam always got her wages. Michael French, again, 18. And it took an awful long time, as you can imagine, from a fire. But thankfully, DNA advances helped. Michael French, 18, from Coolock, again, up the road. If you go from the Artain Shopping Centre, the other, the next nearest shopping centre is the Northside Shopping Centre. And that's, you're in the heart of Coolock. Michael French from Coolock, his dream was to make life a bit easier for Mam, read by his sister, Caroline French. Where are we now, John? Do you know who's our target? Go
Thelma
ahead.
Fraser.
Thelma Fraser. OK, so I want to at least talk about David Flood, who has just been mentioned, only 18 years of age, from Beaumont. And people know Bowman's is back up away from Artain towards Beaumont Hospital, which so many people know. It didn't exist at that time. The nearest hospitals in Dublin would have been the Mater Hospital, would have been Jervis Street Hospital, which is now the Jervis Street Shopping Centre. It's everything a shopping centre, you ask. It's the that hospital is now a shopping centre. James's Hospital existed, obviously, on the south side of the city. And when the major accident plan was eventually put into force that night after 1 o'clock, by the third officer of Dublin Fire Brigade, Thomas Keane, and then the chief fire officer, every hospital in the city is automatically on call, and medics are contacted at home to return to their abodes. And remember, the last time the major accident plan was invoked in Dublin was on May the 17th, 1974, for the Dublin bombings. The last time in this country we had a fire that had anything like the horror of what happened in the Stardust was in 1926 in Drumcolliher, almost a century beforehand, in Drumcolliher, when a cinema went on fire and 48 people of the village of Drumcolliher died. David Flood, 80, in Beaumont. He was a bit of a rocker and mad into the Rolling Stones. And I think the Rolling Stones played in Slane shortly thereafter. And they're still going. That's the lifetime we're still living in. And his nephew, Kieran Flood, read out that tribute. Thelma Fraser from Ringsend. A smile so broad and a laugh filled with spring is what her siblings said about her. And she went to the Stardust and never came home, as the song by Christy Moore's memorialised that awful. They never came home. Josephine Glenn from Coolock, again, 16 years of age, a very kind, loving and sociable person, read by her sisters, Sheena and Alison. And then I think we're near, are we talking about Michael? Who are we talking about now?
Robert Hillock.
So I'll get to, then before that is Michael Griffiths from Kilmore. Again, Kilmore is right behind Artain. If you can imagine, they're almost estates that meld into each other. I was only up there this morning. They meld into each other. And Kilmore, in many ways, is famous for having six or seven streets called after the moon landing, would you believe, in 1969. So there's Tranquility Way and Armstrong Way and Collins Way, called after the astronauts and the space, the first man on the moon in 1969. But that's right behind. Right behind the Stardust, and that's why the Stardust was so popular. It was basically the only, it was pubs, if you could get into them, which you couldn't, but there was a dance hall, and the dance hall was the Stardust. And Michael Griffiths, 18, was 18 with his first paycheck. He took us all to the cinema, or the pictures, as we used to say in those days, with his first paycheck, and he loved impersonating Elvis. Robert Bobby Hillock, 20, from Belfast, and his brothers said in a piece read to the tribunal by the late Charlie Bird, I still don't think I will ever get over my brother's death. He grew up in Belfast. His father died at only 25 years of age from cancer, believe it or not. But he's been talked about. And as I say, the coroner is reading out details of every single of the 48 victims. And the verdict on each one of them will be the same. And she will read out the verdict at the end. Bobby Hobbs, 21, from Whitehall. His sister, Pat, said he'd grown into a fine young man, full of charm and chat. Huey Hogan from Artane. He had a beautiful voice and he loved to sing everything from Bowie to Bob Marley. And who was the coroner talking about now, Tara?
Murtagh
Kavanagh, 27. He was not formally identified as a victim until 25 years after the Stardust tragedy. And this fact, as you can imagine, added to his family's pain. And those of us who have visited the Stardust graves, a lot of them are out in the cemetery in Sutton. There was a section up to 10, 15 years ago. There was a section, believe it or not, in the world we're living in, there was a section for those victims of the Stardust who were not formally identified. And they had to go through, the families had to go through, of the unidentified, had to go through an exhumation and DNA test, which finally, gave identity and some closure to the families. Hopefully today will give them the closure. Another element, nothing will ever close on the death of a loved one. Nothing will ever close on the wound that the death of a young person causes. Martina Keegan, you all know this name. The last, because of Antoinette Keegan and her mother. The last Valentine, Martina Keegan, 16, brought a card, a Valentine's Day card, with her to the Stardust to give to her boyfriend. She was the fourth child, born in the Coombe Hospital in Dublin. And her mum and dad, Mary, Antoinette and John, they were all living in a single bedroom in Ballyfermot. It broke when the family were born. She died in the fire, Martina, 16, and her sister, Mary Keegan, she died as well. And her brother Damien said at the coroner's inquest, "I would sit on the doorstep every day waiting for Mary to come home." And as I say, and he said, she was really beautiful inside and out. And I think you could say that about everyone. Mary was the eldest of eight children, born on the 14th of June 1961, died on the 14th of February 1981. I need to take another break and I'll do so now.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And the coroner is going through each questionnaire which the jury were handed about the cause of death. Obviously, it varies, but not much, from rapid incapacitation due to inhalation of fire fumes and heat, inhalation of fire fumes. She's already, and she puts it to the foreperson or the foreman of the jury each time, is, am I correct? Robert Kelly, 17, from Coolock, and she reads out the answers to the questionnaire. Robert Kelly, to humanise him, he had lots of hobbies and one of his favourites was embroidery, read by his friend Antoinette Keegan. And remember, Antoinette Keegan is a survivor, not just a sibling of two victims of the Stardust, but a survivor herself. And you have heard her testimony of the horror of that night, the heat, the electricity going off, the panic. And you will be hearing a lot more from the powerful voice of Antoinette Keegan later on today. Mary Kennedy, from 17, from Kilbarrick. Again, and a little bit further from Coolock and Artane, but not too far down the Kilbarrick Road. It would be the nearest fire station to Artane would have been Kilbarrick. And indeed, that was the first fire appliance in attendance that night. And it's worth remembering that given the extent of this tragedy, a number of firefighters had relatives and indeed children who died in the conflagration at the Stardust. Mary Kennedy loved music, dancing, and that's the reason her sister Michelle said she was in the Stardust that night. Mary Kenny from Coolock, she was very happy going out the door that night, her sister Angela said. She was the eldest daughter of Sarah and Michael Kenny and a big sister to Carol, Paul and myself. And Margaret Kiernan has been mentioned, her verdict. Again, died, rapid cause of death, rapid incapacitation due to inhalation. Loved her makeup and dressing up for any occasion. And indeed, Margaret is one of the few victims where we actually have a colour photograph. And that is a reminder of the times that we lived in. And the family said in their testimony, read by their friend Deirdre Dames, on behalf of Margaret's brothers, Jimmy and John, the night of the Stardust fire was the night that broke our family. The night that broke our family. Sandra Lawless, 18. She didn't go out very often, her brother Brandon said. She didn't, but when she did, you could set your watch by her arrival home. And many parents can say that. Sandra, she didn't come home. She was 18 years of age. Francis and Maureen Lara. By the way, the coroner is going through each one, and they say to the four person after each person, they say, are you satisfied with identity? Are you satisfied that you can come to a conclusion about the cause of the death, the medical cause of the death? Francis and Maureen Lawler have just been mentioned from Finglas. We spoke to their daughter, Lisa, who was orphaned by the death of her parents, only aged 25 and 23. And as she told us earlier, she was 70 months when her parents were died. Paula Lewis, all of Paula's, who was 19, by the way, all of Paula's family miss her every day. She never got the chance to live her life. She was from Coolock, and her brother John said she was our big sister, my mother's right hand woman, and my dad's pride and joy. Eamon Lockman, 18, was the big brother who looked after us and protected his siblings so much. He was from Beaumont, again, 18 years of age. That was read by his cousin, Carol, on behalf of his family. He played ball. He looked after me, played ball with us. He gave me crossers on his racer. You all know what crossers are. They're crossbars on the. If you're lucky enough to have a bike, the best thing you could do was have a friend with a bike of you who had a crossbar on it. Donna Mahan was only 17. The coroner has just referred to her, and the four person of the jury has just verified her identity. 17 from Edenmore. Again, Edenmore, Kilmore, all parts of Artane. You go back into Harmanstown, where Larry Mullen is from. People know there the Malahide roundabout where you two went to school, which was only down the road from the Stardust in Mount Temple. Edenmore, another estate across the main road there. And Donna loved her life, loved her role in the shop where she worked, and loved all the people who came into it. And she lived in Edenmore all her life, and she worked in Dorkins, the local newsagent. Helena Mangan was 22, and she loved to dance and loved music, her daughter Samantha Curran said. Before my mammy left that night, she gave me a big kiss and a hug. She was one of six children, born to Francis and Josephine Mangan, and was the second eldest child. And Helena was 22, and Samantha was only 4 when her mother died. Georgie McDermott, in the list he comes up as George, but everyone, as they reminded me down at the inquest, his family, everyone knew him as Georgie. He was so funny, one of the nicest people you could meet. And he was 18, and that testimony is read. A testament was read by his sister June, and the McDermott family had three testimonies that day, believe it or not. Marcella McDermott, 16, from Raheny. Music was a big part of her life. She never stopped dancing, said her sister Selena. She went to the Stardust, and as I say, she loved dancing. And her friends all came from Edenmore, Coolock, and then across further on the north side in Finglas. Willie McDermott, 22, the coroner has just referred to his case and asked the foreperson of the jury the same questions. He was 22. He escaped from the Stardust, but he went back in to try and rescue his brothers George Georgie, who I've just referred to, and his sister, Marcella. And why wouldn't his other sister, Louise, say, he was our big brother who protected us all from a family of 10, 8 siblings and our mother and father. We lived in Edenmore Crescent in Raheny, and even though we ranged in ages from 11 to 24, we were very close and we all looked after each other. Julie MacDonald was 20. And Julie was 20 years of age and from Coolock. This is all fairly formulaic, is it, John? I know there's human stories.
This is the where, when, how part of the inquest that has to be undertaken in any inquest, and then the circumstances relate to the overall verdict that'll cover all 48.
Yeah, and then she's the coroner simply asking questions to the four persons.
She's checking that all the questions
and he is just simply replying each time, correct,
yes.
correct.
They've recorded all this in their answers to the questionnaires already.
And I know, and I hope people will, one, become so conscious of fire safety in the world we live in. Mm. Really, I hope they do, because even we were covering it a few weeks ago on Liveline, for HICWA reports about fire safety in nursing homes. And I did refer to the fact that I've been in at the inquest to the Stardust, which happened over 40 years ago. We need still to be extraordinarily conscious of fire safety and extraordinarily conscious of the devastation.
The last witness that the inquest heard from was the current Chief Fire Officer for the Dublin District, Dennis Keely. Even the jury's questions indicated that they were interested in current fire safety practices and inspections and self-certification. So they may well have recommendations.
OK, that'll be interesting. The coroner has just referred to Julie MacDonald, 20 years of age, from Coolock in Dublin. She was fun, loving, happy, smiling, helpful, caring and thoughtful. And that was read by her niece, Pamela. Pamela said, I'm 41. I never met my Auntie Julie, but 14 months after her untimely demise, I was born into a grieving Stardust family. We were known, like so many, as a Stardust family. Teresa MacDonald, 16. She loved hair, makeup and beauty. And her brother Richard and sister Lorraine said, she was a beautiful girl, only 16 years of age, who loved life and tried to enjoy every moment. And to the world, she was a name read aloud on the news. But we lost everything that night. Again, trying to humanise the victims of this horrific tragedy. Gerard Kavanagh, his photograph is with white polo neck jumper, so common at the time, his little moustache. Gerard was only 21. And Gay McKeown read out a piece on behalf of his late sister-in-law, Liz McKeown, who was Gerard's sister. And Gerard was only 21 and he was from Coolock. And he said at the time, I hope this inquest will deliver justice to Gerard and all the other victims. Caroline McHugh is being talked about at the moment. She's from Artane. Do we know when we get to the 48 pen pictures, which are really, really important, I think, and is another indication of how this inquest has humanised for a lot of people the tragedy that when we get to the end, does the coroner speak, or is it up to the four persons of the jury then to give more?
I think it's handed over to the four person to deliver the verdict of the jury, which covers all 48.
Yeah, okay. So once the four person of the jury gives the verdict on the first person, that's the, I hope he will go through every one. Mm. But
there's also a general questionnaire that they've been asked to answer in relation to the incident as a whole. So
okay, and that might lead to recommendations.
Mm.
Yeah, well, hopefully. And I know we've moved on even in households in terms of smoke alarms, but many people have checked their smoke alarm, and many people this morning turned off their smoke alarm because it was gone off when something happened in the kitchen. Plug it back in again, please. Caroline McHugh, 17, from Artane. Her family said, a day never goes by without her thinking of her beautiful daughter. And that was read by her parents, Phyllis and Morris McHugh, friends of mine. They Caroline was their only child, and she perished and It's like so many families. Phyllis and Morris have been campaigning. You've seen Morris on television, I hope, numerous times. Phyllis and Morris have been campaigning for years to try and get more information about what happened that night. And I'm proudly wearing the badge that Morris gave me when I was at the tribunal in memory of his daughter and the other 48 victims. Jim Miller was 20. He was engaged to be married from Belfast. His sister, Laura, said, "I'm telling this story as all our family have died, leaving only me to tell it. It will be short, as his life was. There were three boys and two girls in the family. I am the oldest, and Jim, 20 when he died. There's 18 months between us. I was a tomboy," said Laura, "and I followed Jim and his mates everywhere. And again, look at the photographs that you'll see on the television this evening and indeed in all the newspapers tomorrow." Susan Morgan was 19. She was full of life, so bubbly, so funny, so thoughtful too. Her friend, and remember at that age, remember how close you were to all your friends. Read by a friend. Yvonne Graham said, "Susan was my friend. She was raised by her granny and they doted on each other. We were part of a group who moved from Derry to Dublin. We were pals going to work together in Nazareth House, which is a nursing home about 500 yards from the Artane Centre, the Stardust. But she said, we all worked together in Nazareth House just down the road. I can imagine the excitement among the gang of young women as they headed up to the Stardust that night." David Morton was 19. He's classified and identified and humanised by his brother Alan with the words "very outgoing, confident, charismatic." And very quickly he had begun to realise his own potential before he died at the age of 19. David Morton from Artane, from a family of four. As in many cases, David's father has since died. Kathleen Muldoon was 19. The coroner has just spoken about her. Went to Dublin to pursue, like so many, a career in nursing, originally from Kells in County Meath. And her brother Hugh Muldoon said of his darling sister, "She was the eldest of the 10 of us. She was a very mature girl, very helpful to her family, and she helped with many household chores. Good natured, thoughtful and helpful. What a magnificent nurse that woman would have been." And she died when she was aged 19 on February the 14th, 1981. George O'Connor was 17. His family told the inquest at the start, "We still have notebooks of some of the drawings he enjoyed doing," and how many budding artists have started at that age. "I had a big brother who was on this earth," said his sister Donna, "for 17 years, 10 months and 12 days. And I think it's now 15,709 days since that awful fire in Artane. That's how long we've waited. 17 years, 10 months and 12 days. He may just be a body number on the inquest list. But in fairness, I think the coroner has changed that picture for a lot of us. But to us, he was the firstborn, a grandson, a big brother, a nephew and a cousin. George O'Connor was 17. Brendan O'Mara was 23. His family said at the inquest, nobody had a bad word to say about him. He was a good, honest and decent fella. What better testimony would any of us want on our headstone? And his niece, Suzanne O'Mara, read out the piece on behalf of Jimmy O'Mara. He was 23 and 21 when he died, and he had an older brother and sister. John Stout was 18. He went to the Stardust with his with Helena Mangan, who was his girlfriend, who also died in the tragedy. And you've heard brother siblings died, of partners, of husbands and wives dying. John was 18, and his niece Alison Foster said he was very quiet, very sensitive, very gentle. He really didn't like conflict. He was cautious, good at school, a great learner, loved snooker and loved Elvis. That was John Stout, and God rest him and all those who we're talking about. Margaret Thornton, 19, studied dressmaking and worked in the various sewing factories after school. And her sister said, from Summerhill in the centre of Dublin, and her mother worked three jobs, like so many women in Dublin and around the country, to keep this family. Paul Wade is the final victim, it's done alphabetically. He was 17. He was the most outgoing and one of the most, the one who had the most friends, read by his nephew Emmett on behalf of his brother Tony. There were five of us boys and our mother and father. Paul had a twin, Liam, and a very funny little lad. We always went on our holidays to Kilkee in County Clare. My mother would be in the kitchen working on to see him with a fella, a new friend who from Cork. So now there's a general questionnaire which is being handed to the coroner. We'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we're covering the results of the inquest. The general questionnaire is now being dealt with by the coroner. The jury have found that the fire started in the hot press in the dispense bar. The cause of the fire, they're now being asked, which was yes, they came to the conclusion. And the cause of the fire, according to the jury, an electrical fault in the hot press in the bar, which is different to the original verdict. An electrical fault. The time at which the fire started. Now, this was a source of controversy because people outside saw a fire earlier before people inside. And they said they were unable, the jury are unable to determine the time the fire started. And then, as I said, there was different people outside saw the fire. They reported outside and they said, yes, they can determine. They came to an agreement what time the fire was first seen from outside the building. Between 20 minutes past one in the early morning of February the 14th and 20 minutes to two in that 20. That's when people outside saw the fire. So it started well into the early hours. And now they're being asked, did you can determine the fire, what time the fire would have started inside? And they said they have come up with a conclusion. And again, a majority verdict on this. So it's the fire was first seen inside the starters at 35 minutes past one, which is 15 minutes after it was seen from outside. So in other words, the building, the roof would have been in flames. You can imagine how the fire was spreading during those 15 minutes. The polyurethane foam in the seating is regarded as advancing the fire. The height of the ceiling in the west alcove, again, you all know the tiered seating. That was also helped accelerate the fire. Fire exits. And the carpet tiles on the walls, did they contribute to the spread of the fire? Very controversial. Yes, the jury have decided. And we heard about the carpet tiles almost from day one. And now they're talking about, was there any impeding of the victims escaping from the fire following its outbreak? and the factors that the coroner asked them to consider are the lack of visibility, obviously the black smoke. Yes, that impeded exit, escape. Lack of knowledge of the layout of the building. Yes, that impeded. Remember, gases, toxicity of gases and smoke. Yes, that impeded escape. The heat of the fire, did that impede escape? And the answer was yes. The speed of the spread of the fire, did that impede? Yes, yes. There was an emergency lighting system and that failed. And the jury said, yes, that hindered escape. The lack of staff preparedness, did that impede escape? Yes. Were any of the exits locked? Locked, chained or otherwise obstructed, is it? Yes. So the exits were locked, chained or obstructed. The jury have decided that was the case. Because there was a lot of debate about that. You know, that was strongly and vehemently denied by a number of people. Were any of the deceased impeded in their ability to escape, to access emergency exits? Yeah, so the victims, a number of the victims were impeded from escape. And were they impeded in exiting through the emergency? And the answer is yes. Did any of these factors cause or contribute to the deaths? And the answer is a clear yes. Did any of these factors cause or contribute to the deaths of the 48? Yes. We're now talking about the emergency call to the fire service. First phone call was made at 1:43. Gardaí arrived 7 minutes later, and the district call, which would be protocol in Dublin Fire Brigade, that it was a major issue. 51, the Dublin Fire Brigade declared a district call, which would mean a number of fire engines would have been dispatched, and a number of emergency tenders, or an emergency tender from Tara Street, as well as a number of ambulances. And the emergency disaster plan was activated at 2:06, and that went from stage one to stage two. Quickly escalated. Anyone who read the Keane report will see this, that it quickly escalated, because the moment the first fire tender arrived from Kilbarrick, the station officer on that fire tender immediately knew this was a major, major disaster. And he escalated it immediately, and it was escalated again. 42 died in the premises. 6 died after removal from the Stardust in Artane on February the 14th. Remember. So that's the questionnaire dealt with. Probably the most devastating finding there is that the deaths were added to by the inability to make their escape through doors which were chained, locked or impeded. The coroner is now asking, is all those findings common to all 48? And the jury are saying yes. So the verdict is about to be delivered, is my understanding. same verdict for each of the 48 who died. And the same verdict. So the verdict of the jury in each of the 48 cases. Unlawful killing, which is the verdict, which is the verdict that the families were. So you can, I presume, I can hear some activity in the room. I presume it is tears. I suspect a lot of tears. But the jury in the Stardust inquest, the longest ever inquest in the history of this state, in the effect of the fire. And the families are obviously consoling each other, and the coroner is asking them to if they can, and she's asking in a very sensitive way, can they manage their emotion. But the verdict in the Stardust inquest is unlawful killing. What does that mean, John? What does it mean?
Well, it means that somebody unspecified, to a very high degree, disregarded obvious precautions that should have been taken according to the standards of the time to preserve human life.
So it is the most devastating verdict.
It's the equivalent of manslaughter.
And it is the one requiring the highest proof.
Proof beyond reasonable doubt that must have been satisfied.
But that's the family. The main thing for the family is the consolation and the vindication for those 48 families.
Absolutely, yes.
And I'm thinking of the survivors as well.
But I mean, given their answers to the specific questions in the general questionnaire, it's not surprising that they reached a verdict of unlawful killing in relation to the blocking of the exits, for instance.
But the conclusion of the verdict of the inquest into the Stardust fire on February 13/14, though it's clear that the fire did not start until the early morning of February the 14th, but the verdict of the jury on every single case of the 48 who died is unlawful killing. Back after this break.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m.
And the jury in the Stardust inquest have decided by a majority verdict in the case of every single one of those who died that they were unlawfully killed. And there was also the jury are now making recommendations about public buildings and places of a resort. And as we finish today, the only way to finish, and thanks to John O'Dowd and Tara Lockery-Grant, who are with us, and Una Kelly down at the Pillar Room, but above all, the families who have cooperated with us. And today's programme is dedicated to Michael Barrett, Richard Bennett, Carol Bissett, James Buckley, Paula Bourne, Caroline Carey, John Colgan, Jacqueline Croker, Liam Dunn, Michael Farrell, David Flood, Thelma Fraser, Michael French, Josephine Glenn, Michael Griffiths, Robert Hillock, Brian Hobbs, Eugene Hogan, Morta Kavanagh, Martina Keegan, Mary Keegan, Robert Kelly, Mary Kennedy, Mary Kenny, Margaret Kiernan, Sandra Lawless, Frances Lawler, Maureen Lawler, Pauline Lewis, Eamon Lockman, George McDermott, Marcella McDermott, William McDermott, Julie MacDonald, Teresa MacDonald, Jared McGrath, Caroline McHugh, Donna Mahan, Helena Mangan, James Miller, Susan Morgan, David Morton, Kathleen Muldoon, George O'Connor, Brendan O'Mara, John Stout, Margaret Thornton, and Paul Wade. May they rest in peace. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.